From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump says he will announce his nominee to replace the late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Saturday. And Republicans now say they have the votes to confirm that nominee, despite arguing back in 2016 that confirming a justice during an election year was the wrong step to take. Here's Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham last night on Fox News.
The nominee is going to be supported by every Republican in the Judiciary Committee, and we've got the votes to confirm the judge, the justice on the floor of the Senate before the election, and that's what's coming.
NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. And Kelsey, only two Republicans, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, have said they would not support a vote before the election. And this morning, Utah Republican and Trump critic Mitt Romney said he won't be joining them, that instead he will support a vote on a nominee.
I recognize that we may have a court which has more of a conservative bent than it's had over the last few decades. But my liberal friends have over many decades gotten very used to the idea of having a liberal court. And that's not written in the stars.
Kelsey, does this basically mean a vote before the election is a done deal and the nominee will be confirmed?
Well, at this point, we don't know exactly when a vote will happen. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been very careful not to commit to a timeline here. He has said that a vote will happen this year, but he has not said that it would be before the election, in part because that would be, a kind of a record-breaking feat at this point. Republicans were quick to point out to reporters all throughout the day yesterday that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was confirmed in 42 days. And 42 days is exactly how long there is from this day to the election. Mm. And President Trump has said he will not be nominating somebody until Saturday. So they would be racing against an extremely tight clock if they hope to get it done before the election.
Do Democrats have any standing at this point? I mean, there are talks of impeachment and adding justices to the Supreme Court if Democrats win control of the Senate. How likely are those scenarios?
At this point, Democrats have very little control over what will happen when it comes to voting on a Supreme Court nominee. They cannot prevent the Senate Majority Leader from moving ahead with a vote if he has enough votes to do so. However, they can turn this into a bigger, broader political issue, which is what they're doing by having those conversations about packing the court or impeachment, as you mentioned. It's because they are running right now not just for control of the White House, but for control of the Senate. And Democrats mm-hmm. are now honing in on a message that essentially a vote in this upcoming election will determine whether or not there could be the potential of adding justices to the Supreme Court. And, they're also talking about things like the Affordable Care Act, and they're also making this about abortion rights. So this has really honed the message for Democrats about what is at stake in the election beyond just who is in the White House.
President Trump met yesterday with appeals court judge Amy Coney Barrett, considered to be the lead contender to take this open seat left by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Why is she seen as someone at the top of the president's list?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for Amy Coney Barrett to be. She is well supported by Republicans, and she has a track record as being very supportive of the anti-abortion rights movement. She has spoken of unborn victims of abortion, and that is extremely appealing to Republicans as they weigh whether or not to attempt to repeal Roe versus Wade. So she has a lot of appeals for Republicans, in addition to the fact that she's been vetted, which makes it much easier for her to move forward.
Very quickly, who are some of the other folks that are on Trump's list that he's considering for nomination?
Yeah, one person that we hear about a lot is Barbara Lagoa of Florida. One of the things that President Trump has spoken about pretty frequently is that he's talking about young jurists, primarily people in their 40s. Another person mm-hmm. Is Alison Jones Rushing, who's the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and she's 38. So this is a young group of women who mm-hmm. the president would like to advance.
Mm-hmm. That's Kelsey Snell, NPR congressional correspondent. Kelsey, as always, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
As the country passes 200,000 deaths from COVID-19, an NPR analysis shows that the disease is shifting away from the country's biggest cities. Of the first 100,000 deaths, less than a quarter happened outside large metro areas. Now that's almost doubled. It's nearly a half. Further out in rural areas, the number of deaths has nearly tripled. We've got NPR data editor Sean McMinn and standing by Kirk Siegler, who covers the urban-rural divide for NPR. He's based in Boise, Idaho. So, Sean, stat guy, start with this statistical divide. Remind us, why did this happen?
Right. So at the beginning of the pandemic, it started obviously outside the United States, which meant that our international ports of entry were initially the most vulnerable. So New York, of course, made up a big chunk of the first 100,000 deaths, and that's one of the most urban cities in the world. So there maybe was this feeling in the beginning, it's only happening in these places because people live so close together. It's not going to spread to small towns and rural areas. Unfortunately, that's not how it played out. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is you had some people who were fleeing those urban areas and bringing the virus with them. So what can start as a small outbreak can spread much quicker if you don't have or you can't afford, you know, a big contact tracing effort, public education outreach, or whatever else some of these larger cities' health departments have been doing.
Yeah. Well, and then Kirk Siegler there in Boise. Early on, we spoke to a nurse who went from Boise to New York City to help and was shocked at what she saw. And she wanted us to warn people back home, this could come to you. Was she right?
Well, yes. And even at that time, actually, here in Idaho, there was a big outbreak going on in a rural area. But broadly, I would say, you know, rural areas, you're naturally socially distancing. And there was some reluctance to adopt some of the coronavirus restrictions because people and businesses felt like, well, here was another policy crafted with only cities in mind. But, you know, it became clear quickly that rural areas were not going to escape this just by geography. And that was the big fear, that these rural hospitals that don't have the capacity, that they'd get overwhelmed and then the cities would be overwhelmed and they wouldn't be able to transfer their patients there. And, you know, we have seen some pretty big gatherings, I should mention, too. In fact, there was a large rodeo the other day here in Idaho where a lot of lockdown restrictions have been eased, but it's not like the cases are dropping that fast in any way.
Well, and Sean, again, NPR's data editor, how does this urban to rural shift change how we fight the virus?
Well, in some ways, it is a little bit easier to deal with in rural areas, but that doesn't mean that people are totally living in a bubble. You still have these big events. And in fact, what kind of surprised me in reporting this story was Father's Day. I talked to a public health official down in South Texas where his county had hardly any cases during the spring. And then he said it started all around Father's Day. That day became part of this chain of events that led to this tragic situation where they're at almost over 1,500 deaths at this point. That's in Hidalgo County in South Texas.
Right, right. We've reported on that. And where else have we seen a spike outside of cities?
Places like Broward County outside Miami and San Bernardino outside L.A., they both saw big increases in deaths over the last few months. There's a place called Gallux, Virginia, which is in the southwest of the state. They have 20 deaths there, but only 7,000 people live in the city. So on a per capita basis, that's worse than New York City, even though New York was, of course, much higher in the number of people who were killed by the disease.
Yeah. Well, and then Kirk Siegler, again in Boise, we know that essential workers in inner city hospitals are more at risk. But is there something about the lifestyle or kinds of jobs people in rural areas have that make them more or less susceptible to COVID-19?
I think it's fair to say anecdotally that a lot of people here don't or, you know, can't work from home. In Southwest Idaho alone, there are lots of Latino farm workers close to me. You think of the meat packing plants. And, you know, and just generally more blue-collar jobs where you're working in sometimes close quarters where you can't really socially distance. And I think, Robin, you know, we also have to consider the messaging here from the highest levels of the Trump administration. First, we were told masks didn't do anything from government officials. You know, words matter. People are confused about what to do. That said, a lot of people still are taking this virus very seriously. You do see people wearing masks in grocery stores, especially in places where they're required to.
Sean, data guy, your takeaway here.
Yeah, I mean, looking at the numbers here, what really struck me was how you can have a community that can go from being completely fine to having an outbreak and then having deaths follow that in an unfortunately short amount of time. And of course, when that happens, people, they then start wearing masks and they start social distancing more. But you don't want to be in that position where you are changing your behavior after people you know get sick or die. You want to stop that in the first place.
NPR data editor Sean McMinn and also Kirk Siegler, who covers the urban-rural divide for NPR. He's based there in Boise, Idaho. Kirk, Sean, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, whose members are also known as Mormons, has a complicated racial past. Black Americans were among its earliest converts, even served in leadership roles. But they were barred for over a century from entering the priesthood or Mormon temples. That position wasn't reversed until 1978. Now, after protests forced a racial reckoning throughout American society, many Mormons are taking a renewed look at racism in their own faith. One of them joins us now. LaShawn Williams is a licensed clinical social worker and an assistant professor of social work at Utah Valley University. She's also a co-founder of the Black LDS Legacy Committee, which organizes a yearly conference about Black Mormons. LaShawn Williams, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The church has an official partnership with the NAACP. The two issued a joint statement condemning racism just this past June. Can you talk about the significance of that partnership in light of the church's history?
I think it runs the risk of being a symbolic partnership as opposed to a practical partnership. They offered in the Medium piece where they initially spoke out for racial unity that they would explore ways together to work together to improve self-reliance and upward mobility for inner city and minority families. And so one of the spokespeople for the NAACP said that those were minor efforts and they don't befit the stature and magnitude of what the LDS Church can and should do, and how they were looking forward to the church doing more to undo the 150 years of damage they did and how they treated African Americans in the church.
You worked with the church on a 2018 event celebrating Black members of the church, 40 years after the church repealed the priesthood and temple ban. But the church never really apologized for enacting that ban. Do you think they should?
I think that one of the best ways to show leadership is to do what you ask your members to do. And as a membership, we are told that whenever we harm our brother, you go and make good with your brother first, and then you go off into the rest of the world. And I would love to see the church issue a number of statements. They came close. They released an essay that disavowed any previous practices, folklore, thoughts, or ideas that were perpetrated by church leadership about the reasons for the ban. They did not go so far as to call the ban wrong or to call the ban racist, but they disavowed all of the explanations that were given and said that they currently disavow racism and that it is not connected to the gospel of Jesus Christ.
You co-founded the Black LDS Legacy Project, which puts on a conference every year about Black Mormons. Why is this event important? And are there any figures in Black Mormon history that inspire you in this moment?
The Black LDS Legacy Conference came from the broken hearts of Black women after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in 2013. We were having interactions with other Black members wondering, why is no one saying anything from the pulpit? How come we go to church on Sunday and it feels like we're the only ones who care about what's happening to Black people here in the U.S. in the wake of police brutality? And so we created the conference to be able to say, we have a place here. We've always had a place here. We'll continue to carve out space for our place. A few Black members that are inspiring to us, our first pioneers, the first people to be baptized into the church, or the first ones to hold the priesthood, or the first one to join the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, or the first ones to be baptized outside of the United States. And we listed all of their names on a t-shirt to go along with so many of the other Black history pioneers, Malcolm and Martin and me. And we took that same energy and applied it to the church experience for Black members and Black history in the LDS Church, because holding on to ancestors, standing on the shoulders of giants, is what allows us to continue moving forward. And there's work to be done in every place where Black people set their feet.
What is your call to action for ward members?
You know, I think the biggest thing that every single ward member can do, for the ones who serve a mission and it's international, and they come back and say, I really grew to love the people in this location, show me. When you come back from a place like continental Africa, or you come back from Afro-Latino countries, you come back from the Caribbean and from the West Indies, Do you translate that learning into your actions here back in the U.S.? Are you out marching and engaging in conversations for Black Lives Matter? Are you addressing structural, educational, and employment inequalities in Black communities? Or do you reserve your love for the people you served because you felt like they needed you and you had something to give? For my members in wards and congregations, you've got the privilege, you've got the power, and with great power comes great responsibility, and we need to be using it more to make reality, equality, and freedom happen for others.
That's LaShawn Williams, Assistant Professor of Social Work at Utah Valley University and co-founder of the Black LDS Legacy Committee. LaShawn, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Tanya.
And many white Mormons throughout the country are also taking up the call to discuss race in their church communities. Diana Brown, Assistant Director for Interreligious Engagement at Georgetown University, is doing just that. She's organized a church study group on race that has hundreds of participants. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Tanya.
So you're having these really difficult conversations in this group. I'm also wondering about feedback you've received. Are other white Mormons specifically willing to discuss these problems? Do you ever get resistance from friends or family members?
There is certainly like a faction of people who I think are a little resistant to this, who see this as part of revisionist history. But I would say that the majority of people that I see are very, very open to it. We had everybody answer a quick question, why do you want to take part in this? And I think what I find really remarkable is how I'm seeing people really seamlessly blend language that we're drawing from this anti-racist movement that, you know, is largely happening outside of our church with rhetoric about personal change, ministering, building Zion, building community that's very common in the church. Mm. For the most part, I'm really not seeing those things come in conflict. I'm seeing people bring these two aspects of themselves, these two moral projects, so to speak, together into one place.
So you've invited scholars and church leaders to give presentations. What kind of conversations have you had?
Yeah, so we've brought different speakers and scholars to come based on their either their professional or personal expertise in this topic. And so it's ended up being a blend of sort of their scholarly work, personal experience, and then sort of wherever the conversation goes from there. So a few of the conversations that we've had, we had Brother Ahmed Corbett come. He's a first counselor in the General Young Men's Presidency for the church, so a pretty high leadership position. He also is African American, and he sort of talked about his initial draw to the church and to the Book of Mormon as, to use his terms, the most racially unifying book of scripture out there. Mm. We had an indigenous scholar, Farina King, come in and talk about a passage in the Book of Mormon that's often interpreted to be referring to Columbus. And she was just sort of raising the question, are we wanting to glorify Columbus at the expense of our indigenous members of the church?
It sounds like this is a very educational experience. What are some of the common questions you get from participants?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the goal was to kind of have it be like an academic Sunday school. Mm. This wasn't a fringe group of people who ended up coming to this, you know, based on the comments that we were getting and the questions we're receiving. These are people who are pretty central in the church and involved in church leadership and things like that. And I think their common questions are just wanting to really understand the perspectives of minorities and people of color in the church for pastoral reasons, wanting to know how to do better outreach and ministering. I think a lot of them have questions as well about how to reconcile some complex aspects of the church history, mm-hmm. and how can they maintain their faith and testimony in the church while acknowledging the pain that people of color have experienced due to certain policies and cultural norms, and what to do about that.
Is that what brought you to this topic? You decided to start this group. I'm interested in and your motivations.
Definitely. So I think growing up, I was taught to take the church very seriously. And I took very seriously this idea that no human life and no human experience is wasted, that somehow all of this fits into the bigger story of how God is working with humanity. So I've just always been a fan of being brave to take our doctrines really seriously and mm-hmm. to go to the margins and like really amplify those voices and to be thinking more deeply and broadly about like how we're all connected to each other and how we absolutely need these stories and they're all a part of us and we just should not be afraid of them. And if we're taking our most core doctrines seriously, we should be the most engaged in causes like this, not the least.
One last question for you, Diana.
Yeah.
Do you see a future where the church's racist past won't be at the center of these types of conversations, but you'll be moving forward in a way that feels more inclusive?
That is a really good question. I think these are difficult to answer in the context of the Latter-day Saint Church because it's so young that all history feels really recent. Mm-hmm. I do think that people are really hungry for a theological reckoning, mm-hmm. something that is saying, how do we make sense of the fact that this happened? Mm-hmm. I feel like as a community, we need more spaces to hold that question together, whatever comes from it. And I think that's kind of what's necessary before we would be able to move on.
That's Diana Brown. She's co-organizer for a study group on race and the Book of Mormon. Diana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The markets are clawing back this morning after the Dow finished down more than 500 points at the close yesterday. Also today, Fed Chair Jerome Powell and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin are testifying before a House panel about the need for a new coronavirus stimulus package. Let's bring in Robert Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
I'm good. So yesterday, that was not good. The Dow falling by more than 800 points at its lowest point in the afternoon. Markets open a little better, the S&P 500 rising for the first time in 5 days, the Dow climbing back. Is it fair to say, though, that this dive was because of the lack of the stimulus package that Mnuchin and Powell are testifying about?
I mean, it's September, October is almost here. So if not for the pandemic raging on and an election just a few months away, we get Washington now transfixed on another bruising Supreme Court nomination battle. And that, yes, Robin, that's going to poison the mood for any sort of cooperation to get more fiscal relief done. And today we saw Fed Chairman Powell on the mic noting that the job market has only regained about half of the 22 million jobs that were lost just in March and April. So we're in a deep hole.
Yeah. So the political convulsion is adding to all of this because they know nothing much is probably going to get done. Tech stocks also rebounded slightly after sliding in recent weeks. They'd been doing well earlier in the year. So what's going on there?
Against all odds. I mean, this run since the spring. If you think about it, the tech-heavy NASDAQ has surged from around 6,600 to a high of 12,000. And that was in just months, in the teeth of the pandemic. So you were bound to see a correction. Now we're closer to 11,000. In the grand scheme of things, it's not the worst thing.
Yeah. How about the oil industry? All this uncertainty. Oil prices rising over the summer, more cars did return to the road, but we don't know what's ahead. You know, we're looking over at Britain, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but, you know, they're having their second wave and new restrictions. So talk about the oil industry.
Yeah, if I had told you to start the year that ExxonMobil, the prodigal, you know, child of Standard Oil, would have been booted from the Dow Jones Industrial Average, that so many airplanes would have been mothballed, that cars are just sitting idle outside as we all work from home. So right now, the fear is that another leg down in the global economy, I mean, you're seeing COVID infection rates shoot up in many influential top 10 economies. That's going to beget more demand destruction in the parlance of the energy sector.
Yeah, but then how does Europe impact all of this? Rising infections there are, you know, people are really in shock and the markets are as well. And then we see Prime Minister Boris Johnson of the UK announcing new restrictions today. He said they could last up to 6 months. What impact does that have?
Yeah, in nominal terms, the UK is the world's number six economy. So it has outsized clout, not just on the US, but across Europe and in developing frontier economies across sub-Saharan Africa. So for that size of economy to visit its deepest recession on record, after all, GDP there fell by 20% in the second quarter, that's going to worry the world. And a full lockdown now to end the year versus London's importance to immigration, to transcontinental air and rail travel, yes, that's going to be felt across the global economy.
Okay, just a quick lightning round here. We've been talking about TikTok. China is announcing it'll blacklist foreign companies that unfairly treat Chinese companies. Just a few seconds thoughts on that.
Yeah. And so a company like Cisco, which is the nemesis for Huawei, should be worried. Every multinational in the United States that is on vendor lists in China should be worried.
Okay, we'll end it on that note. Everyone should be worried. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, always getting right to the point. Thank you. A quick news note now on a story we're following. The Washington Post is reporting that William Cruz, a public affairs specialist at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is run by Dr. Anthony Fauci, has offered to retire after the Daily Beast revealed he was also the managing editor of the conservative website redstate.com, where he wrote vicious tirades against masks and the government response to COVID-19, saying those responsible should be executed. A spokesperson at the NIH agency says they'll investigate whether he wrote the posts while at work or using agency equipment, both of which are prohibited. Well, now to our ramped-up coverage this week of climate change, part of Covering Climate Now, a week-long global journalism effort. Today, leave it to the beavers. It turns out these industrious buck-tooth rodents who do much good are also unwittingly contributing to climate change. Ken Tape is a research professor at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, one of the lead authors of a new study on beavers and climate change in northwestern Alaska. It's published in the journal Environmental Research Letters. Professor Tape, Ken, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Well, thank you for driving right under your cell tower there so that we could talk to you. Let's set the scene for people. This damage is taking place in the northern tundras, traditionally too cold for trees and vegetation, things that beavers need. And it's permafrost that's being damaged. This is the land that's been frozen for at least 2 years, but usually, you know, hundreds or thousands of years. So this seems like it's not a hospitable place or hasn't been for beavers, right?
Yeah, up until recently, we haven't had beavers in the Arctic tundra. And we've noticed in satellite imagery over the last 20 to 50 years that beavers have been moving from the boreal forest and building these beaver ponds in the Arctic tundra.
They can, because you and others have determined that climate change warmed the region. So there's now trees and vegetation they can eat. They can build these things they build. And now the gnawing question. I'm so sorry my colleague Karen wanted me to say that. So remind us what it is that beavers do.
Well, so beavers build these ponds, right, along creeks and streams. And they build these ponds because they need the ponds to escape from predators and to float woody vegetation down to build their dams. And in doing that, of course, they inundate these areas that were just tundra vegetation before and had permafrost underlying the ground, and them building these ponds is beginning to thaw the permafrost underneath.
Well, and you say build the ponds, but what they do first is they build the dams, and damming up the water, it creates the ponds, because with those teeth, they can just chew down trees. They're amazing.
Right. Well, of course, in the tundra, there aren't trees either, and I think that's what initially surprises people, is that beavers can live in the tundra at all. So they're actually chewing down these shrubs and using moss and sedges and mud to build these dams, to form these ponds. And yeah, they're engineers of rivers and streams and lake outlets and things like that. So when they get into a landscape, they completely alter it. And I think everyone has an experience of seeing, you know, beavers create these miniature wetlands in the landscape, and now that's happening in the tundra.
I have to say, I'm fascinated by beavers. I mean, what they do when you see them, when you're lucky enough to see them if you're hiking or something, it is astonishing. Not just what they do, and you're saying that normally it's trees and sticks and things, but now they are even doing it with this vegetation and moss, that they construct these things. And it's not just that they construct them, it's where they construct them. They even know how to put them in outlets and things so that it will create ponds.
Yeah, I mean, evolution has taught beavers to be almost perfect hydrologic engineers. They know where to put their dams, they're very efficient, and they're incredibly industrious. You know, they spend all night working on these dams, and if you've ever camped near a beaver lodge or a beaver pond, you'll hear them all night swimming back and forth, chewing down shrubs. And so, you know, and many times, of course, we get pitted against beavers because they're building a pond in some place that we don't want it to build it. That's an uphill battle for us, working against the beavers.
Well, especially now in the Arctic, where it's been a building boom. A few years ago, there were two dams in 2002. Now we understand 98 or so, five new dams a year. Also the huts that they build to store food. Talk about these ponds. You mentioned, of course, this was once this permafrost. Now there's water on it. The water presumably could get warmer than the permafrost and melt it. What are the concerns there?
Well, permafrost is the global concern of this issue of beavers moving into the tundra. Permafrost has been frozen in many cases for thousands of years, and beavers move into the area and they inundate the tundra. And when they flood the tundra, that water transfers heat to the ground better than the pre-existing tundra vegetation. So immediately when you build ponds on permafrost, you begin to thaw that permafrost. And so that's sort of why this is more of a global concern. And, you know, you can release the greenhouse gases, carbon and methane, that are stored in that permafrost. That's the global concern. But really, the beavers transform the entire ecosystem. You know, the water becomes warmer. The biodiversity probably increases, fish are affected. And so they're really creating these focal points or oases on the landscape for boreal species to gain a foothold in the Arctic.
Well, and the greenhouse gases is no small thing. The permafrost, things are frozen in amber in there, including greenhouse gases, things that are trapped there. So there is concern about the gases going into the atmosphere. You're also reminding us that they're changing the landscape and you have new habitat. What should be done about this?
I don't think we've even really got to the stage of mitigation yet, because we're still trying to figure out where and exactly how many of these ponds are being built. You know, we saw in our study area, my colleague Ben Jones at the University of Alaska was the one who led the study. And he saw that, you know, in this smaller study area, over 20 years, it went from two dams to 98 dams. In the larger study area, I think it was 94 dams to almost 500 dams. And we're seeing those changes across the Arctic tundra of Alaska. We've seen indications that similar trends are occurring in Canada, in Eurasia. So we're at this point really just trying to get a handle on how rapidly are these creatures colonizing the tundra, and what are some of the basic impacts that we should expect in the coming decades?
Well, another reason that the beavers are there is that they're no longer being hunted the way they were, you know, when perhaps their pelts were more valuable.
Yeah, beavers are still rebounding from all the overtrapping in the 19th and early 20th century in Alaska. So it's partly that climate change is growing taller shrubs and making for more unfrozen water habitat in winter. It's partly that climate change is improving their habitat and allowing them to move into the tundra. But it's possible that we're also seeing partly a rebound from overtrapping in the last two centuries. So it's probably a combination of those two things. And in terms of mitigation, as I say, we really haven't got to that point yet. I don't think anyone wants to go out and shoot and trap a bunch of beavers, and I don't see fur coming back into vogue anytime soon. So what to do going forward, I think, is a difficult question.
But in the meantime, it's just, again, it's an understanding of, wow, you know, there are so many, it's like the butterfly wings, you know, the flutter that can be felt around the world. An industrious beaver may be having an impact on our climate.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's unique about beavers is there's lots of animals that are responding to climate change, species moving northward, for example. But the beavers are pretty unique in that they, like humans, are exerting their own impacts, imparting their own changes on the landscape as they do that. And I think that's what makes them exciting to study scientifically and perhaps a little bit scary.
In the range of seriousness of climate problems that we're looking at, where would you put this? Beavers potentially helping melt permafrost, which then will release carbon and other methane gases into the air?
I put it pretty serious. And the reason is that if we were talking about a few dozen ponds, this would not be a very big issue. It'd be more of a novelty. But what we're really talking about is a novel disturbance regime in the Arctic. What we're really talking about is 10,000 ponds in the Alaskan Arctic tundra that have appeared in the last 20 to 40 years. And so when you start to extrapolate that to a global scale, you're really looking at potentially hundreds of thousands of beaver ponds that have been these oases that have been added to the landscape. And so I think it's pretty important now and could be very important going forward.
That's University of Alaska Fairbanks Professor Ken Tape on how beavers may be inadvertently contributing to climate change in the Arctic. For a link to this fascinating study, go to hereandnow.org. Ken, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
But wait, don't turn on beavers just yet. National Geographic is reporting they've also been climate change fighters in other parts of the world.
Federal antitrust regulators could bring charges against Google as soon as next week, according to media reports. If that happens, those headlines could drown out the rosier story the company is sharing this week, which is that it's planning to power 100% of its operations with carbon-free electricity by 2030. Lee Gallagher is director of external affairs at Google, and she joins us now with more on this. Hello, Lee.
Thank you, Tanya. It's great to be here.
And Lee, before we talk about climate change, I want to ask you about the news today that the Department of Justice is expected to brief state attorneys general this week about plans to file an antitrust lawsuit against Google after opening an investigation last year. Google has already paid billions of dollars in fines to European antitrust regulators. What sort of preparation has Google made in this case? Are you expecting similar fines here in the United States?
Well, you know, we certainly understand the scrutiny. We have worked with the regulators to answer questions, as we have in the past, and we always do. We are focused on building free and helpful products that help people every day, that help generate an enormous amount of economic activity, and we're constantly innovating on those products. So we feel pretty good about the way we innovate and the way we compete, and that's what we're focused on doing.
Okay, let's get to the climate announcement. So just to clarify, you're talking about powering 100% of your facilities with carbon-free electricity by 2030, not just offsetting fossil fuel consumption with investments and renewable energy elsewhere.
Yes, that's exactly it. We are aiming to be the first major company to run on carbon-free energy. And our goal, as you say, is to get there by 2030. And when we say run on carbon-free energy, we are, as you say, referring to all of our operations, so our data centers and our corporate campuses around the world. So it's an audacious goal.
Yes. I mean, Google uses about as much energy each year as the state of Delaware. That's according to the company's own accounting that you release nearly 5 million metric tons of greenhouse gases in 2018 alone. That's roughly the equivalent to what a million passenger vehicles might put out in a year. So how exactly do you cut a number down like that to zero?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have a long history of doing this. We were the first major company to go carbon neutral, which we did in 2007. We took a look at our consumption, and even though we were matching, and even though we announced this week that we were the first major company to eliminate our legacy carbon footprint, what we're talking about is no offsets, no credits, no accounting, just fully decarbonized. You know, part of the way we're going to do this is, first, we're going to continue to match and expand our purchasing efforts. You know, we use things like AI to help reduce the overhead for cooling our data centers by 30%. And we'll catalyze development of new technology. And a big way that we're going to do that is by working with our supply chain. You know, it takes a whole ecosystem coming together. So a large part of our efforts are enabling that ecosystem.
Your statement says carbon-free energy. Does that also include nuclear energy?
It does. We believe that the goal and full decarbonization for everyone requires a diverse portfolio and a number of technologies, both renewable energy and other technologies.
Last year, about 2,000 Google employees joined a global climate strike and petitioned the company to stop selling data storage and other cloud computing tools to oil companies. They've also called on the company to stop funding think tanks or politicians who deny the existence of climate change. What do you say to critics who want to see you do more to combat climate change beyond cleaning up your own power supply?
Well, again, I go back to our long history in sustainability. I think if you look at our actions, you know, it really does show that this is a core part of our values. And, you know, we made the largest purchase of corporate renewable energy ever last year. We were the first tech company to really buy renewable energy at scale. So we have been hard at work for this for quite some time. And it's clear that we're committed to this goal and to this effort.
What's your response to the argument that that this is great, that Google is making investments in carbon-free electricity, but climate change is a societal problem, and maybe that we should do more, and a company like yours could do more to further society's interests by actually being taxed and really deciding as part of the democratic process how to spend that money on climate action rather than relying on giant companies like yours to decide how and when to make those investments.
Well, we do think it is a societal issue, and that's one of the reasons we're doing other things as well. We plan to use our voice to develop and advocate for policy changes needed to rapidly decarbonize. I mean, don't forget a lot of the policy world has to come on board, too, to enable the development of these technologies. And then we also want to enable our users, the billions of people that use our products, to be able to take action and make choices for themselves to live sustainably. So that's why we have things like in Google Maps. We provide low carbon transit options. We show EV charging stations. You know, we want our users to feel good about our hardware, too. So our shipping is 100% carbon neutral. And a lot of that goes back to driving the changes in the supply chain that I mentioned.
That's Lee Gallagher. She's Director of External Affairs at Google. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Tanya. Great to be here with you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.